Painting the Big Picture: Capacity Challenges in Natural Resource Management. This is the first forum in the 2012 Fenner School Forum Series, hosted by the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the Australian National University. This forum took place on the 29th of March 2012.
Good afternoon. Thanks very much for being here. Welcome. Welcome to the first of the 2012 Fenner Forums. Today's forum's the first in a series of what we think will be six events convened by the Fenner School of Environment and Society to address what we see as some significant emerging challenges in our capacity to manage our environment and our natural resources. I'm Peter Konoski, for those that I don't know. I'm a Professor of Forestry here in the school, and on behalf of my colleagues and our students in the school and our director, Steve Dovers, who's unfortunately detained in Melbourne, I welcome you to the first of this series of forums. We look forward to your contributions and the discussion this afternoon, both in this room and informally over a drink at the end of the proceedings in not more than 1 hour's time. We'll begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the country that we're meeting on, the Ngunnawal people, and acknowledge their custodianship, their interests and their rights. The management of Australia's environment by Aboriginal Australians and non-Indigenous Australians' somewhat belated recognition of that management, I think, are important contexts for some of the topics that we'll discuss. So today's forum and panel are focused on the big picture of some of the capacity challenges we face, not in an exhaustive way, but more in an indicative way. And in subsequent fora, we'll explore particular aspects of this more general topic. As you may know, this year is Year of the Farmer, and we'll be focusing in subsequent fora particularly on issues related to agriculture, but we'll certainly touch on those today. So today's panel, whom I'm about to introduce, bring complementary perspectives to the table, and we have three panellists who've been making a difference, and I hope I have been too, so I'm counting myself as a fourth. If I could just introduce them briefly, Phoebe Howe. Phoebe's a recent honours graduate of this school. Her honours thesis was entitled Communication and Change, Action Research Exploring the Knowledge-Action Gap for Sustainability. And she was, amongst her academic work and other work, an active member of Canberra Loves 40%, as you see from her T-shirt, a community-based movement that sought and succeeded to secure political commitment to emissions reductions targets. Next to Phoebe, Dr. John Williams, known to many people, I think, a member of the Wentworth Group of Concerned Scientists, a former chief of CSIRO Land and Water, recently retired as New South Wales Natural Resources Commissioner, and joined the ANU only recently. So welcome, John, in that context. John's been, in all of those roles, a leading advocate of changing the way that we manage Australian landscapes. And then Professor Jim Prattley, Jim's Secretary of the Council, the Australian Council of Deans of Agriculture, and also a member of various national committees working to address skills shortages in agriculture and natural resource management. He's a former Dean of Science at Charles Sturt University, amongst his other activities. And for myself, Professor of Forestry here in the Fenner School, recently retired, I think would be the word, as a member of the 2011 State of Environment Committee. It's a pleasure to see colleagues from that work here. And in both my ANU role and in the State of Environment role, I've been concerned about capacity in environment and natural resources management generally, and in forests in particular. And of course, we're interested in your perspectives and look forward to hearing those in the discussion that we're soon to have. Format for the evening straightforward. We'll have a brief presentation from each of us on the panel, an open discussion, And we'll finish by 6:10 at the latest, so we can move to have a drink. And you're all invited to please come and join us for a drink next door. The forum's being recorded, so if you don't want your contributions recorded for posterity, please say them very softly. The ceiling mics aren't on at the moment, but we'll turn them on when we come to the general discussion. So a word of caution that those sort of George Bush asides about bombing Russia and so forth will be recorded. So I'd like to, with that general background, I'd like to begin with some comments from my own perspective about the challenges that I see that we face. And a couple of pictures that illustrate some of the ways that I think about that. I think about the challenges that we face in terms of the next generations of Australians and indeed educated people from elsewhere in the region who we help to develop their knowledge and skills in Australia. The challenges that we face in educating those next generations with the knowledge, with the ways of thinking, with the skills that they're going to need to help respond to the environmental, the social, economic dimensions of the world that we're going into, a world that I think is going to be somewhat different in many significant respects from that we've experienced, the impacts that climate change is going to have, for example. I also think about a picture from colleagues in the Centre for Aboriginal Economic Policy Research and their People on Country project. I think about the challenges we have in communicating knowledge in both directions, from formal to traditional systems and back, in building capacity in people who live on country, whether they're Indigenous or non-Indigenous, and how we in the education sector play a role that helps with that two-way transfer of knowledge. These are some pictures from the State of Environment report, available online as well as in paper. On the left, a picture of the state of our rangelands from that report a couple of years ago. On the right, a picture of the likely biological consequences of climate change under some scenario modelling work done by Mike Dunlop and others at CSIRO. And in that chart on the left, red's bad, if you like, and blue's good. So, you know, our rangelands are in mixed conditions. They're the most extensive systems by area on our continent, and how we manage the rangelands has a lot of consequence for the general state of our environment. On the right, the darker purple colour indicates a greater difference from current environmental conditions from a biodiversity point of view. So the darker the purple, the more different the environment, 2070 medium climate change projection. What that graph on the right says to me is how different the Australian environment is likely to be in 50 years' time. The darker colour in that graph have no current analogues biologically in the Australian environment. It's an enormous contrast, I think, that we're looking at in terms of expected impacts of climate change on our environment. So we've got to think about how we help develop ways of thinking, ways of understanding, ways of responding to the changes that are in train in our environment. A couple more graphics from the State of Environment report, principally to make the point, these are assessment tables and the direction of the arrows and the colour of where the arrow sits indicate our judgment about whether things are getting better or worse and how good or how bad they are. Red's bad, green's good, down's generally bad. You can see it's, you know, not a happy story, it's a mixed story. But the conclusion we came to in the State of Environment work was that some of the significant pressures on our environment and on our natural resources are not the same ones that have challenged us most until now. We've been challenged by the consequences of land clearing, fragmentation of remnant vegetation, the immediate and the legacy impacts of those sorts of changes to land use. Those still, of course, have a legacy impact, but there's a compelling body of work that suggests that the impacts of invasive species, the impacts of new pests and diseases, are going to be much more profound drivers of environmental change in the future than they've been in the past. How do we think about the skill base and the resource base to address those? And in terms of, you know, my own professional experience and focus and responsibilities, I think about the particular profession that I'm part of and the set of skills and contributions that we can make to management of the Australian environment. The graph on the left is the downward slide in enrolments in forestry degree programs at Australian universities, different universities as well as the total. And the picture on the right is the opening of the Australian Forestry School in Yarralumla back in 1927, when forestry was so important that the Governor-General and Prime Minister showed up to open the school. Haven't seen Julia here lately, but no. Or Quinton, for that matter. But that, you know, 70 years ago, government saw a significant need for professional education in a particular domain of natural resource management, and invested in that in the form of that fine building that's heritage listed there in Bank Street, Yarralumla. The world's changed a lot since then in higher education as well as in other respects, and that's not how government sees the sector functioning now. So that presents another set of challenges to us, not just in forestry, but in forestry amongst other discipline areas. So in conclusion, from, you know, my opening remarks, when I think about the challenges that we face, the capacity-related challenges that we face, some of the challenges are not new. Some of the challenges relate to managing environments in the oldest, driest continent with an enormously variable climate, with pressures for food production that are likely to grow rather than diminish, with legacy impacts from previous land use practices. All of those sorts of things we're familiar with. But I think about the new challenges that are coming as the world changes, as the climate changes, as the interaction of the way that we now use resources, our settlement patterns, impact differently on our environments and our landscapes. There are some new challenges that we haven't had to face before in the same way. I think about a market-driven higher education system and how that system doesn't respond inherently to expectations that there's a gap between supply and demand for particular sets of skills. I think about institutional change that's taken place in Australian natural resource and environment agencies, particularly but not only in the states, about the loss of capacity, the loss of research capacity, the loss of what we used to call extension capacity, our capacity to translate knowledge into practice. And I recognise that some sectors, such as that Jim represents, have been very active in getting together and beginning to think about addressing these challenges. Other sectors like that I'm part of in the forest sector are still really, I think, not engaged with understanding the magnitude of the challenge. So they're the sorts of points that I'd like to end my presentation on and come back to in discussion as you'd wish. I'd now like to invite Jim Prattley to come and share his views with us. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks very much, Peter. Ladies and gentlemen, a few familiar faces in the audience, so if I get into trouble, I hope I'm protected by them. I've entitled my talk, Looking for a Job. Well, how about thinking about agriculture? Because we have a problem. If we go back to 2007, the policy settings were that in relation to the number of graduates, the view was that there were plenty of graduates in 2007. In terms of jobs for graduates, the official view of government was that there were no jobs. In fact, agriculture was a sunset industry. It's really amazing to think that this industry supplies all the food for our guts. And so if it's a sunset industry, then the outlook's a bit bleak for our survival, I would have thought. The question is, that was the setting, but how are we really travelling? Was that the right setting? Well, in 2007, the Australian Council of Deans of Agriculture were formed, and they hopped on their horses, got their weapons, and they went in to battle in the search for data. Because the settings that we were operating on were based on gut feel and really little data. And so the Council of Deans of Agriculture went back to TORS, looked at what they were doing in all the individual schools around the country and pooled the data so that we actually had a national perspective. Now, that hadn't been done before in the university system, as I'm aware, in any discipline, because when you've got bad news to tell, you don't tell any of your competitors. So this was a big change in attitude in the university system, or at least part of it. And so the data that we were able to get shows a pretty ordinary picture. And so you can see in the late 1980s, the data come from the McColl report, which is a well-known report into agricultural education, shows that in agriculture and agricultural science, we were producing around about 800 graduates. And the McColl report said in those days that that wasn't enough to support the industry. And yet, if you sort of look at the trend that's taken place in the last decade, it's just onwards and downwards. And we've gone from something like 800 in the 1980s to something under 300 in 2010, and 2011 numbers will not be any better than that. So a 60% drop in 20 years. That's not sustainable. We've tried to fudge that number up a bit, and so we've added graduates in horticulture and viticulture, in agricultural economics, in agribusiness, and in animal science. We can't actually add all the animal science, though, because animal science represents not only livestock production, but wildlife and companion animals. And probably more than two-thirds of those animal science graduates are not in livestock production, and I'm not sure what their job prospects are like. So if you take about a third of the animal science numbers and go across the left-hand side, you're around about 700 a year. So 700 graduates a year we've got up to that might contribute to the knowledge base in agriculture. So what about the jobs? How do you get data on jobs? Well, we thought about this for a long time. We used the Productivity Commission's data about the number of people in agriculture, and we use their data on the percent with degrees, came up with a number and divided it by 20 based on a career average of 20 years, and we came up with about 2,500 graduates needed a year to sustain the current lot. But when we then found that we could get the data on the number of jobs that were advertised in Australia, then we're at least able to say, well, this is what the employers need in terms of graduates each year. And we've now got 5 years of advertisement data. We've had to back off the absolute numbers because we've used the internet and the paper to provide those numbers, and there's about a 20% overlap in subsampling that we did. So we've dropped them by 20%, And there's a bit of churn there, so if you employ somebody, you've created a vacancy somewhere else, and that has to be advertised. But of course, that's balanced a bit by the direct approach by companies to individuals, and that happens a lot. And we've not been able to capture those jobs that take place in the local workplace in particular centres. Nevertheless, so the numbers were about 6,000 per quarter. We've backed off by a third. We could back off by another 50%, if you like, and we're still nowhere near what we need. The numbers tell us that there are around about 4,000 jobs per quarter, every quarter, over the last 5 years. That's 16,000 jobs a year. Of that, there's about 2,500 on-farm production jobs, and there's about 1,500 a quarter in agribusiness jobs. And those jobs, those proportions are pretty similar across the base. Now, you could ask, if we just take the agribusiness ones, where most of the graduates will go, then we can separate those into various sectors of the industry. And the pattern's pretty interesting, but the one thing you might do is cast your eye across that 100 line, and you'll see that in every quarter, in every segment of that graph, there are at least 100 jobs in each of those per quarter, 400 a year. So we talk, obviously, crops and livestock, they're two or three times the rest, but nevertheless, we're talking lots of jobs across every aspect of the agricultural industry. So you don't have to be a mathematical genius. You don't even have to get into ANU maths to understand this issue. We're talking about a need for 4,000 to 6,000 jobs, and we're supplying 700. Interestingly, we're not supplying enough graduates into agriculture to sustain the very low level of tertiary education qualifications in the industry. We'd need about 2,500 graduates to do that. So, the policy settings in 2012, fortunately, are that there are plenty of jobs and a shortage of graduates. And we can be thankful that the government has been responsive and they've turned the policy settings around 180 degrees. So, give agriculture a go, because agriculture is actually important. It's important to the Australian economy. It earns 20% of the export earnings of our country. If the minerals boom busts, then it'll be agriculture that'll be the main contributor. Agriculture does good. It provides Australian people with the quality of life that we're all used to. It provides it 12 months of the year with good quality, best quality food in the world. And we then contribute to feeding some of those billion hungry people internationally. And the other issue is that we actually do it rather well. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. And you saw the desk that you signed on the way out. That's going to be turned into a sign-up for agriculture desk that you can respond to Jim's challenge there. Thank you very much, Jim. Let's move to hear from John Williams. John.
There you go. Sounds a worry. Right. Get on there, Jim. You know, I'm one of those greens that man was worried about. Okay. What I want to talk about is this general picture of the capacity challenge in natural resources, but particularly to give a big frame for the way natural resource management, in which agriculture sits, is changing. And I think not only it's changing, I think we're coming to understand how to pull it together and weave it together in a better way. And I think that, you know, we're talking about natural resource management that does include the suburban settings. We've got to move on from the idea that it's something only in the regional or rural. And it's got to recognise that natural resource management is about producing the energy and the gas supply systems and the coal supply systems and the mineral systems. And we have these sorts of patterns across the landscape to manage in the future, because we need that energy, I believe. And we also need to recognise we've got the wildlife issues and the habitat and the heritage values and the functionality in having ecosystems in our mosaic in our landscape that are producing the natural services. And of course, as Jim says, this is irrigated agriculture. And of course, a lot of the community don't really see that as all natural resources. We've got a communication problem with natural resource management. It's not necessarily well understood. I can't find better words for it. The Minister and I have conversations, I'm sure you're aware, Ian, of how to find the language. But it's to recognise that it is all of that. But it's more than that also. It's about managing the coastal systems, the rural, the water, and the where we put our infrastructure. These planning decisions have impacts on the natural resources and the functioning of our landscape and its well-being in a very profound way, as does the issue does on the natural systems of national significance, whether that's a forest or a barrier reef or an important marine ecosystem. And of course, agriculture is knitted together in that whole system and so fundamental to stitching the Australian landscape together in a way that provides the benefits we all want and need, and does it in a way that one industry doesn't impact in a way that takes away the long-term advantage of another industry operating. How do we have dairying in a floodplain which also provides our oysters and our prawns, and that they come together? And so again, that's all what I call natural resource management. Now, getting our head around thinking about managing all that together is a demand on our skill base that we probably haven't utilised and had before. And I think that the two big ones that I think are critical to think about is how we put the skill sets together to deal with the issue like this is coal seam gas in central Queensland, all that movement of getting that gas to Gladstone, and there'll be eight ports the size of Gladstone if it goes the way it does. And that's just coal seam gas. We haven't even thought about how shale gas will go. And shale gas reserves in Australia are absolutely huge. And we've got to somehow stitch all that together in the way we produce our food and manage our water resources into the future and maintain our biodiversity and ecological functions that are critical to us. And so the issue is then his coastal one is a classic. They've got the picture of the coast on one side, and then we've got the picture on the other side is Kiama and how we're habitating, how we're actually doing our urban development on the coast. So urban development and how we manage the population pressure in Australia, particularly on the coast and in some larger regional centres, is a critical way to managing our national resources. And putting all these competing forces together that start off with population growth, that must be up front of mind. Not just talk about limits and size, but how do we manage the fact that we're going to have twice as many people in the country in the next 80 years? Now, how do we do it? How do we put it together? Well, we got to think about having planning processes and mechanisms. How do we make sure in doing that we don't put our feet where we actually need to grow the food? And our energy, where do we manage that? The huge need in our transition, we'll need the gas energies. How do we put it together? The water, maintaining the biodiversity and doing all that, recognising we're going to have climate change, and that will impact even more so on the variability, which is a characteristic of being Australian. So I think we've got a few things to think about. We need to think in whole systems, having skill sets that can do that, to bring about NRM planning and delivery in new ways. The first thing, we've got to look at the whole system. So that looking at the whole system, the linking of the social, ecological factors and breaking down the silos. And of course, it's good to be in the Fenner School to be able to say that, because the intellectual framing of it in this school is to try and bring together the skill sets we need that can bring the biophysical and the ecological and the social and the economic together and to do that. And that's a new set of skills that, that will be built and was part and built into the agriculture degree that I did, where agricultural economics and rural sociologies was built into the system. It's got to be there and we've got to do it better. And of course, the way we do that is about working with people in the first place and engaging with our communities, whether through local government, regional bodies, industry bodies, churches and football clubs and whatever it is, because bringing stakeholders together to develop shared goals and to coordinate policies and actions on the ground. And one of the ways we've experimented with this in New South Wales, at least, is through the catchment action planning process, where we actually do seek to do integrated catchment management, which is whole of system, whole of communities. And we've shown that it can be done and it produces a real way to avoid the polarisation and the shouting and the yelling. We've got a long way to go, but we think we know that we can do it better. But that requires a different set of skills and understanding and facilitation in managing our natural resources and the food and the fibre and the stuff we produce. One of the key things to do that, I think, is changing that in our planning, natural resource management is about planning and integrating our planning and land use planning in a sensible way. At the moment, we invest very little at the top of the triangle in a strategic regional framing. We spend all our time in the development assessment at the bottom of the triangle, which we have our environmental impact assessment, which doesn't deal well with the incremental effects. One mine here is fine, two mines might be very different in terms of water resource, and the same is true with an agricultural land use or the development of an urban settlement in a place. We can see some of the problems we've got in the Hunter Valley and right across Australia. And we're going to have more of those to manage as part of our thing. And we've got to move it across where we tip the triangle upside down. We do a lot more of our thinking at the strategic end and where things fit. Where are the aquifers and where are the coal measures? Where are the agricultural land? And where is it just stupid to try and do one on top of the other? And where can we do it with safety and minimise all the costs and fighting and going on and the typical planning system? Then the development assessment at the end often becomes self-evident. There's good data for that, and that's strongly based on anyone in the literature who's reading how planning people think. But this integrated catchment management is about a new set of skills too. It's considering the current and desired landscape trajectory. What's your world going to look like? How's it going to change? How do I see it? How do I value it? How does it fit together? Understanding how it works, understanding how the Australian landscape works and the boom and busts, droughts and floods, plenty and famine. And underlying with that, the aspirations of people. Do we all want to be yeoman farmers? Do we all want to be corporate farmers? How do we get the mix? Well, we need to start to find mechanisms that as human beings we talk about it. Australians have got a proud record of working out ways of solving problems without killing each other. And I believe we need to keep working on those, but the training in our students of the future with the science and the social science, the facilitation process, and having the forms of governance, which I think we've evolved in Australia with the big investment in National Heritage Trust. And I think the Commonwealth need to really take a bow. I mean, they've invested a lot of money in that. And what's come out of it is a set of governance and regional structures and capacities at local government through to region that have the opportunity of doing what I'm talking about. So we've got to somehow stitch all this knowledge together. And having the skills to do that are going to be really important. And I think we can do this integrated catchment management that is whole of system, and it's based on a powerful way to manage our natural resources under climate change and other pressures and population into the future. And having the skills and the people to do that adds to the pressures I think that Jim so beautifully has set upon us. And I think that is one of the challenges, to have the incentives for people to work in this area and not to dislocate agriculture from and fisheries and forestry from managing our land and our minerals as a whole. It's a whole system we're in, and we don't need the silos, and we do need the ways of working across it. And I think the capacity, and as this is a point that Peter has left with us, the State of the Environment Report does a lot of really good things, and I do congratulate those who put it together. It's up to us to articulate it and make sure it's used. But what it does show is the ability of people to do all the things that I've been talking about is thinner than we realise. And I don't think that until this report came out, and along with the work of Jim, have we got this on the table, that to do the way, have the technical and scientific and social economic skills to help manage the Australian landscape into the future is a challenge that sits before us, particularly tonight, and I hope we can bring attention to the fact. And we all want a place like this. It's people and place connected. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John, for bringing the breadth of experience and perspective to the issue. Phoebe. Is that right?
Yep.
Wonderful.
Okay, so my name is Phoebe, as you're all aware. Now, I'm a graduate. I finished here at the ANU last year. Did my honours study here as well. And tonight I'm going to be bringing a slightly different point of view to the conversations that we've been having. So we've been hearing a little bit about the challenges that we have currently with some really amazing knowledge that we have in all these different areas of environmental challenges that are upon us. But how we use that knowledge effectively is a really big issue. And also whether we keep that knowledge base growing through the training that we're providing and the graduates that we're seeing. Jim was talking about one thing that I'm going to be touching on a little bit is data and how important it is to have data around the issues that we're looking at. His example was, you know, graduates and how we can totally miss-see a problem if we don't have the specific data available to us. And some of the really nice things that John brought up there were how what I'm going to speak about a little bit too, a lot of what we know technically is going on in the environmental field links with so much of what's socially going on, and how social barriers and enablers have to be used if we're going to make an impact in how we manage our natural resources. But today I'm going to talk a little bit about the climate change issue and my experience as a graduate heading out into the world and being involved. Now, I've got a very particular role. I'm a climate change campaigner here in the ACT to do with local climate change issues. This is a campaign that I started as an undergraduate here at the ANU, and it was to do with setting a 40% emissions reduction target for the ACT for the year of 2020. So you might say there that that's a policy success in terms of climate change science and seeing scientific recommendations that we start to take that level of mitigation effort towards climate change, and that's a success that in at least this jurisdiction we're taking that level of action that a lot of the knowledge that I was presented as a student is telling us we need to be taking. But what I wanted to share a little bit about is the social and cultural barriers to seeing that sort of change happen. And as a graduate, how you need to understand and navigate that world if you want to be involved in making that change happen. I'm going to briefly outline some of the challenges I see around the climate change issue in Australia, and I think maybe what will be pulled out of the climate change issue may impact on other natural resource management areas. I'll tell you briefly about what I've learned and what skills I've used to affect in the campaigning and the work that I've done since I've left university. And I'll then propose three key issues that we need to be aware of and have skills around as graduates who are dealing in the kind of area that I'm dealing with. Just to bring it back to the fact that this is the social kind of challenges that I'm looking at and where my interest lies. I think that that's a really important issue because with a high level of knowledge and expert opinion, I think, on a lot of environmental issues in Australia, the social barriers are really what I identified as an undergraduate that we need to take on, that there's this gap between what we know about our environment and what we're doing about it as well. All right, so climate change is one of those really big issues with social and cultural baggage, if you like, or elements that we need to take on. So I'm going to put a very controversial quote up and to start to illustrate some of the challenges that we see. So this is Senator Nick Minchin, one of our favourites, and bear with me, there's going to be a different side to this story. For the extreme left, the existence of climate change provides the opportunity to do what they've always wanted to do, to sort of deindustrialise the Western world. You know, the collapse of communism was a disaster for the left, and really they embraced environmentalism as their new religion. So this sort of paints that within a particular issue that I, as a student, have seen the sort of scientific or expert knowledge debated about, that ideology, personality and culture start to play a really big role in how we start to deal with that. One thing I learned at the ANU, though, is that understanding different points of view is extremely important. And this is an opinion piece from the Climate Spectator site from Tristan Edis. And he says, commenting on Nick Minchin and others who might share the sort of worldview that he's coming from, For these people, this is about far more than a price on carbon. This is about a battle for Australia's destiny. These people have a grand vision where Australia will become rich, prosperous, and help pull the poor of the world out of poverty on the back of our minerals and energy resources. Even the acknowledgement of climate change as a genuine problem is problematic for these visionaries. Fulfilling such a vision is not just about making money for these people, it's what gives their lives purpose. To say that burning fossil fuels is bad is to call into question everything they've spent their lives working towards. So I think that's actually a really important thing of taking something that someone on the left might take real issue at and swing it around and say, well, what kind of a background does that kind of a comment come from? And this just starts to illustrate that, as I say, identity, personal issues, politics is starting to really muddy the waters of what it is, you know, from the expert's point of view, a practical issue that we need to solve. So these are the kind of challenges that you face as a new graduate coming out into this kind of an issue in Australia. Not only do we have this mix of really extreme, well, this is an extreme example, but a mix of different, obviously, opinions on an issue like climate change, but we also have the challenges of the processes with how we deal with all of those issues out there. So this is a quote from a participant in my honours thesis research last year, and they were talking about the challenges of being, I guess, a leader and trying to make change on this issue in the governance environment of Australia. So this person said, "It's what the press think is going to keep the pot stirred and keep the polls going. It's the adversarial thing. Whatever one party does, the other party says it's no good. The government can't go and do something the opposition has. We could never do that. The poor old government says, we're going to put a carbon tax in. We haven't thought through all the details yet. We're working on it. And the people immediately want to know, how is it going to affect me? And if they go the other way and think it all through to the stage of having something they can say, this is our policy, oh, why weren't we consulted over it? You can't win, whatever you do." So there's a couple of themes that came out of that from quite a few different people in my research, and it was about looking at things like our media. You know, what role do the media play in the kinds of conversations that we have around these really complex issues that, as John said, we need to look at holistically and in a complex way. Also, what kind of avenues does an adversarial political system allow us to learn, to change our position when new information comes our way? And also the sort of short-term limitations of our political cycles. You know, what kind of impacts does this have on the kinds of long-term planning that, as John said, we really need to put in place with a lot of the issues that we're dealing with? So in light of these kind of social challenges that you see as a new graduate coming out of university, I'd like to pull it back to my experiences in my campaign and just a couple of things that I've learnt, the kind of skills that I think have come in handy that were fostered during my degree. So I'm involved in, as I say, a local climate change campaign in Canberra, and one of the big things that we've had a focus on from the beginning is trying to get away from that really polarised climate change debate and look less at how big an issue it is and how scary it is, and more at looking at solutions and saying, what can we do here in the ACT to tackle our emissions, and what kind of co-benefits might those actions have, and try to move the debate beyond whether it's real, whether it's not, and look at, are there things that we can do that have other benefits for our community that are worth investing in? Some long-term planning, urban design, public transport, energy efficiency and energy infrastructure. These sort of issues go beyond the ideological positions and get back into the practicalities, and I think that's something really important that I've sort of seen with these issues, is that looking at the practical and looking at the actions that you need to take can sometimes strip away the baggage of all the other things that get lumped in with this sort of an issue. Now, I know that Canberra is a very different context in which climate change issues arise, so it's been a probably easier place to function with this sort of thing, but I've found that what's been required to be successful is communication and really strong relationships with a range of stakeholders, as John was mentioning in other issues before, understanding the context that what's going on, so the political context, the context of the population that you're trying to speak to and engage with, and also looking at you're having good timing within that context. So understanding who are the people who hold some power to make change, how do you speak to those people, what issues matter to those people, and at what time are you able to make a change, and when is a good time to put your energy in to try and shift something that's going on. Just three of the major things that I've learnt since leaving uni and dealing with this kind of an issue. I think, and this sort of harks back a little bit to some of the skills that I think we need to think about graduates having. First of all, what I've learnt with dealing with social barriers to getting policy changes is that, first of all, what we can measure and what we can articulate is what is real. Now, that's a bit of an abstract sentence, but first of all, what we can measure. Data is key. I was sitting in a policy forum with a whole lot of young sort of emerging policy leaders last week, and we were looking at what are the top policy priorities for Australia in the next 10 years, and environmental ones didn't make it up to the top of the list. They were there, but we really just don't have the data or a way of assessing those issues in a context that can be dealt with by policy people. They're looking at GDP, they're looking at things that we can measure. So what we can measure really becomes important. Secondly, what we can articulate is what is real. So the climate change issue, for example, when dealing with, say, community development organisations, has become really powerful in the ACT when the climate change issue got articulated in their context. So when I talk to community development organisations here in the ACT, they're looking at how climate change is going to impact on low-income earners and the elderly and those who are less well-off in our community. So where you start to articulate a problem within the context of the people that you're trying to work with, that's where you start to see a real problem that can then be you get your teeth into and do something about. Second, action under uncertainty. One of the big things we talked about in my undergraduate degree is not allowing uncertainty to stop you taking action. So adaptive management, it might be an idea that you've heard about a lot. So certainly with climate change, that's going to be a big one, is that we don't have certainty about exactly how it's going to play out, but that shouldn't allow us to refrain from starting to take actions and starting to experiment with what's going to work. Certainly you need to have flexibility and to be able to build into your planning reviews so you can change direction over time. But I think that, it's certainly that when uncertainty becomes a barrier, you just stifle debate and you might miss out on those timescales where you really need to make an impact. Also, I've learned as a graduate that you can't allow uncertainty to stop you getting involved out there. With me, it was not being certain that I could make a difference, but diving in allowed me to learn so much about what the real world, if you like, outside of university is like. And once you're in that context and having conversations with people, that's when you start to get the really practical knowledge that lets you know about what sort of change can be made out there. So uncertainty should not stop us as individuals getting involved in whether it be campaigning or governance or the kind of job you want to go for. That's a really important thing I've learnt. Finally, knowing where and when your actions can make a difference. This is, again, knowing the context that you're working with and knowing where your effort is best spent. And I'd like to pull up something that stayed with me very, very much from my policy work here at the ANU, and I think it describes pretty much something about change processes that it's good for all graduates to keep in mind. This is an idea of discourse coalitions, and it comes from policy theory, but I think it's a really useful little idea. So when we're looking at change, out in the world, there are floating around a whole lot of different issues. So today we've had natural resource management, we've had climate change. So you've got an issue network, which is out there. Within that issue network, say it's natural resource management, you've got all of the different expert knowledge, you've got different charismatic people and their opinions, you've got everything there is to know about that issue floating around out there with different people being involved in it. Within that network, you have different groups of people that we call discourse coalitions who hold different particular points of view on that issue. So one discourse coalition on natural resource management might be that mineral resources and agricultural resources and marine resources all make up natural resource management, whereas a different discourse coalition might strike out one of those different ideas. Now, those circles around those discourse coalitions are broken because there's knowledge coming in and out of those discourse coalitions all the time. Within climate change, it might be a new IPCC report comes out and starts to impact on what those different people are talking about. And some people might leave one discourse coalition and join another, and they develop over time. So for me, it's been really, the discourses around is it happening, is it not happening, and what's the best thing to do about climate change. But what you really need to understand, I think, out there is that there's a dominant discourse coalition. And the theorist that talks about this says that that dominant discourse coalition is the one that gets institutionalised or has the ear of the decision makers. And so understanding that the people that you're trying to target or the change that you think might happen, the people who can make that change happen have a certain discourse about how the world is. And so you're really going to have to understand, if you want to make a change, that you've got to understand what sort of a discourse, what sort of ideas really drive those people who have the power to make the change that you're talking about. And when you can institutionalise a new idea, maybe in the frame of reference that those people understand, you're going to really see the changes happen that you want to see in society. So it's a little bit abstract, but it's a really important thing that I've learned. So there's just a reflection for you on a few of the things that as a new graduate I've learnt out of getting out there about the social barriers to seeing change happen in the issue of climate change. But I'm sure that this does have ramifications for lots of other areas of environmental issues that we're up against. I was going to leave up those talking points. I'm not sure if that might be a good thing to do now, but so obviously, to come back to them, what we can measure and what we can articulate is what's real. Taking challenges on and getting into action when we do have uncertainty, and understanding where and when a difference can be made within a change process. Who has the power and what role we can play in influencing them at the right time. Thank you.
Thank you, Phoebe. Thank you for connecting so strongly the learning from an education here with action in the community. I'll ask the panel to come and take a seat at the front. We started late, so we're beginning the discussion late. If you do, I hope you don't have to go, but if you do, please feel free to. I think we'll have about 15 minutes of discussion before we move to a drink. So I remind you at this point I've got to turn the ceiling microphones on. And every word that you utter will be recorded. So, if you'd like to comment on anything that any of us have said or suggest an issue that you'd like the panel as a whole to respond to, please do that. And we'll try to keep the discussion moving along and wrap up in 15 minutes or so. So the floor is open. If anybody would like to comment or put a question to the panel.
I'll start my question from Kim. You mentioned that there's about four times the number of jobs that is in graduate agriculture. Presumably these reversals of jobs are filled, is that right? Who filled them? What skills do they have? And is there a shortage? I mean, did you consult the employers as to the skills that they require and where they need?
We don't have the resources to follow through on what happened in the ants. All we can do is just monitor the advertisements as they come, and we struggle to do that. So it's quite possible that, but we do know actually that they find some graduates. They pinch graduates from other places. They fill jobs with graduates that don't have the training, and they fill the jobs with people who don't have any training. So then the employers come to universities and say, you're not training the right sort of graduates. And we then say, well, what are their qualifications? And they don't actually have any qualifications, and yet we're getting blamed because they're being trained by somebody else. So we've got a huge problem in agriculture. The one saving grace, I think, is that we actually know what it is now. We did it 5 years ago. And data are all powerful. That was mentioned in the last talk several times. Those data we've collected have now got traction with all the decision makers. We've got a Senate inquiry going at the moment. We've had a Victorian Parliamentary inquiry. We've got the National Farmers Federation saying, yes, we understand now. We've got agribusiness, who have been the greatest complainants, now getting up and saying, well, we actually need to help with this. What do we do? And so we've got mobilisation taking place. What we haven't got is real action yet. That's hopefully the next phase, and hopefully that'll work. Otherwise, we're
thanks for your comment. Sure.
Can I carry on that question? Clearly, you measure bounds and area. I would assume that in many of those areas, they would be generic biologists. There might be a need for at the one line in agricultural science. generic agreement with primary education and many other areas in terms of nutrition research, because of general medical pharma and also nutrition. But that led to that there might be a better way of capturing people who have some agricultural training, but school leaders, by the way, attract school leaders who can care about the study in agriculture. Or you have to capture them for example, or you can assist.
Thanks, Jill. Maybe we could generate, as well as responding specifically there, perhaps generalise a little bit about what, to what degree, to what extent is sort of the education that we should be offering at the university, for example, generalisable, and where do we differentiate into those specialisations that sort of Jill's referred to? John, if you want to comment as well.
Yes, the it is certainly true that we need chemists, we need biochemists, we need biologists, we need geophysicists and all those sort of people contributing to the agriculture. I mean, those enabling sciences are fundamentally important. Where we're missing are in the applied sciences. So the people out the field who bring all these things together, the sort of system stuff that John was talking about, they don't exist. I'm an agronomist, I'm a collector of it, because there are 10 jobs for every agronomy graduate out there at the moment. You just can't get them. And biologists don't fit that bill without the extra training. So your comment about having an opportunity for them to use their biology expertise, because we're still dealing with both a biological and physical system, in a sense, the agriculture, they would have useful contribution to make with training in some of the applied areas. Absolutely right. And it's one of the issues that we're looking at now. How do we train all those animal scientists that don't have jobs in the companion and wildlife area? How can we train them into the livestock area? Shouldn't be too hard. So we're looking at ways of doing that. We're looking at ways in which environmental science graduates might be able to get some of the production stuff and then come into our system. And so you're spot on, Mark. We need to sort of try and attract some of those people, you know, outside the system but with good skills to come into our system and get the training and the useful tools.
John, Amy, anything you'd like to add in general terms to that sort of long discussion?
No, I think it's good.
Other questions?
It's really to the Phoebe's. I think we had Jim and yourself going through detailed the need for people actually know stuff, you know, the hard sciences. John said it's a really complicated world. But I was intrigued by Phoebe's, because she said, well, yeah, you might know all this stuff, but you really have to understand sort of what I call small p politics to make a difference. You need to know where the discourse groups are and how people move and change and how you integrate their mood at the time. That's really a challenge for agriculture, foresters, and anyone in natural resource management. I've worked with for quite a while, and every issue, it's the people issues that are the hard ones. You think the science is hard, come up against the people, make it real hard.
Lots of volume in the audience.
I think that's a fantastic point that you make, and I think that the Fair School is taking that head on. I sometimes wish that I had more time to do more of my, you know, kind of enabling sciences, but I also didn't ask to do so. That's why that fell off the agenda though. I had a couple of friends who did honours with me last year who might be here, but ended up looking at some of the social issues around agricultural systems. And I went on a project with the Centre for Public Awareness and Science to speak to rural communities about climate change impacts and the future of the towns along the Murray-Darling Basin. And it was fascinating to be able to speak about some of the social barriers and things to change with some of those groups who say things like, we get, you know, climate variability. We know how to handle that stuff. What we can't deal with is our local government who's not doing this or that. And what we can't do is get funding from federal bodies and all those sort of things. So I think, I have been pretty well prepared with my degree to start to enter that world and to have some knowledge of that world. And I know I had a friend who was a botanist and graduated a few years ago and was absolutely shocked when they got into the marketplace and
saw some of the really cynical things that we see happening with big agribusiness and trying to recruit and those things, and hadn't really been prepared for the politics of the situation, I guess. So I think that there is a really good shift in at least the education that I've had to enable you to start thinking about those things before you leave, that wedding those two issues, because they're quite different areas, to enable that graduate to both have the technical ability that you need to work on a farm and then have that engagement in the living system. You know, that's a tricky one, is that you need to enable people to have the social skills and understanding to team up with, lobby groups and combined organisations who do agricultural things. So I don't know the answer to that. But certainly it's something very valuable that I think I've got to access to in my degree.
Just a quick point to Ian, the real trick that I've learned in the catchment management area was that to really build an ownership and an understanding of the systems, the resilience of the systems that people are in, you do it by an action learning process, and I think engaging with the people and where they are in the local circumstances was the critical thing. And surprising where the talents and skills came from, often out of the regional and rural communities, and the farm leadership had better skills than you could find nearly anywhere, and understanding how to weave their way and bring in and help people talk through how they saw their aspirations in the social system and the economic system and their farming system, if that was the case, or their fishing system on the coast was part of it. It was just an amazingly rewarding process once you start.
Diane?
I don't know if any of the panel had a chance to look at Bill Gellinger's recent book. It's discovered that obviously there was a very different kind of society pre-European labour and resource management, most of the competitive 21st century industrialised agriculture, etc. But are there any lessons at all for land and resource management as the individual farmer from the Gavin just now?
Well, I think it's an excellent book, and it's a very deep resource for people to look at the social history of this place. Learning to understand how the landscape worked, and Bill's book's got lots of better documented material than I've ever seen anywhere on the way the landscape was and the way the Indigenous people used it and interfered and managed it quite actively. But there's some really good stuff on showing how we've actually changed the nature of the way the water systems work, the actual incision and the fragmentation and disconnection of way water systems worked, and where flooding was a desirable and encouraged way of wetting the landscape, and we've broken it all up and channelised it in most of the way. So there's a lot in that to understand how the natural landscape did work in ways that sometimes I think we've been blind to in traditional disciplines.
Time for a couple more questions, then we'll wrap this up. Down back. Yes.
So my question's about bridging between the community level governance that John was just talking about and Phoebe was alluding to as well, and the higher level governance. So in the community level, we've got this collaborative governance and we've got the experience and we've got lots of good examples, but when it comes to trying to get governments to involve with communities, then you get misses like the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. So how can we improve the capacity to get over that?
That's a really good one. I agree with you about the social implosion that's taken place with the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. It's very clear that the people were not adequately consulted or considered, and there is still hostile reaction to what's being proposed. And that will probably remain, whether it's good or bad. I think because the feelings are really deeply entrenched. I'm not sure that we've necessarily solved all the problems at the
community level, we still have a very concerning disconnect between metropolitan and rural peoples. We've seen that disconnect become stronger with succeeding generations. We used to have it back in the 50s or 60s, but with successive generations, we've moved a generation away from it. And you only have to look at some of the outcomes of the surveys that have been done with school kids, who think that yogurt comes from plants, who think that cotton comes from animals, milk just comes in cartons. It's worrying that our community has no idea where its food comes from. And so somehow or other we've got to rebuild those connections. Not just quite sure how to do it, but we know it's there and we've actually got to act. In terms of the overall government thing, I think the government's actually trying, but it's really hard. And they're dealing with quite diverse groups of people around the country. I mean, you couldn't say that people in Queensland are the same as people in Western Australia are the same as people in Victoria. They're quite different tribes, really.
Every time Queensland votes, we're reminded of that. So, I know that John wants to pick up on that point.
So,
I think I'll pick up from that point is that because there are the diversity of the people, but there's the diversity of their climates and land, I think Australia has built something. And to me, in the way the Commonwealth has built a regional framework, because I think it lets you have a conversation that recognises the diversity that's there. I think to make the connection from the bottom up and the top down is the question that we've spent a fair bit of time trying to explore in the NRC. And what seems to work, and it's only early experiments, but it seems to work if you can have a set of high-level goals that you work to that, maintain and improve the condition of your assets and your functionality of your landscape, whether that's an urban landscape in Lane Cove or a landscape at Lightning Ridge, doesn't matter. But you leave that fairly general, but with strong purpose that you're maintaining and improving it. It then allows the people locally, when the local government and the NR, with the facilitation of the regional body, which recognises the people differences and the landscape differences. And you say, well, what does that mean for me at Lightning Ridge? And what does that mean for me at Lane Cove? And when you go through that process and some of the mechanisms of talking through, saying, well, how does our landscape work? How does our community work? How does it work? And do it through a resilient system frame. We've found amazing ability for communities to start to be able to say how they can operate. So you can go from the top to the bottom. And I think the thing that has gotten that we've got in Australia now is, and I think the example that I think is a good example at the moment is the corridor strategy that has been put on the table, where there's a very strong visionary statement of what we're trying to do that the Commonwealth sets, with the state agency process coming in and saying, well, then we need a governance that helps stitch that together. But in the end of the day, it's got to be a landholder somewhere puts his boots on today and does something different to what he did yesterday in a coordinated way with local government, land care, regional bodies, and we can get that stitching together. The Commonwealth doesn't have those agencies and places that have been set up by the Commonwealth through the NHT and funded and states help a lot are the arms and legs of the national government. And I think we've got to think about that. How do we wire ourselves together as Australians? And I think we've made some experiments that can help us do it.
Phoebe, anything you want to add at that point?
Just from a different point of view again, climate policy is such a different ball game at the moment. But I think at the federal political level, when we think about that issue and many others, one of the things that's kind of disturbing if you look at that little diagram that I used before is who in those discourse coalitions has the ability to have the ear of the decision maker? Who, what resources do you need to be able to have the time, the access to be able to have that conversation? And who misses out on that conversation? And so I think when it comes to, you know, regional communities and, you know, Indigenous groups or whatever else, that just don't have access to that level of engagement, to the individuals who are the ones that come sometimes, or the ones that just get swayed at the last minute, and that's what pushes the policy through. You know, that's the real danger. I think that's the challenge that a democracy kind of faces when it comes to these really complex issues, is that sometimes it just comes down to chance and to luck, and you feel the person who's got the ability to increase your luck by being in the room. So yeah, I guess that's it. I think that what you're saying about good planning and good conceptualization of issues by government, between levels of government, is fantastic. But then being aware of power play within that, you know, when can those good plans, best laid plans, be interviewed with them?
Well, they can. The power plays of learning to know our roles and where we can really function. It's when you actually come down too low and disempower people. Is when things start to fall. When people feel disempowered, you get polarisation.
I have one last question, Nick, and then we'll wrap up the formal discussion.
I just want to go back to the graduates in the GA science and environment area. You've got lots and lots of data about what's happening. Has anybody done any qualitative evaluation of why it's happening? So what's driving the decline in people going to study?
What's driving the decline in agricultural numbers? Yeah, we've certainly done a lot of thinking about it, and there are a range of issues. One is that if you look back to the 1990s, we had business being really sexy together. Yeah, you've got to make lots of money. IT was sexy to go into. The Y2K issue would drag a lot of people into computing, and of course, computing was a new technology, and so we all of a sudden had competition that was promoting itself. If you go to the 2000s, then we've had a mining boom and lots of money you can make there, and we've had an explosion in all the medical and paramedical courses in Australia, and that's quite attractive to people, you know, watching the operations on TV and RPA type stuff. And all the while, agriculture's done nothing about promoting its image, its career. It's let everybody else tell people what its image is, even though that's wrong. And so the agriculture industry actually has to stand up, take responsibility, and start getting on the front foot, telling people look, what it does is important. There are really good careers there. The salaries for new graduates are higher than the salaries for just about every other graduate, except mining and this. So, and a lot higher than veterinary science, and yet you've got a lot of veterinary science graduates coming out. We're now probably 50% hours of power by 2013. So, it's agriculture's fault.
Absolutely.
Here's
TV theory
for
that.
Well, science block. Yeah, that's the way all those are helping.
I'm going to give John and Phoebe a chance to say a last word as well, and then we'll wrap up the formal discussion. Is there anything you'd like to add, Phoebe? John?
The only thing I would add is that I think that it's a pretty interesting time. And I think if we can bring these through these forums, bring to attention the way to get natural resource management, agriculture, fisheries, forestry together, realise that it is an exciting area, the opportunities of multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary work and engaging with people, it's the richest part of the spectrum that I can think of.
Thanks, and that's a perfect note to bring things to a close on. I hope that you've found the short discussion we've had useful. I hope that you feel there's more to talk about, and if you've got time, please come and do that informally with each other and with the panellists over a drink now. I'd like to thank our panellists, Phoebe, Jim and John, very much. I'd like to thank you for joining us and invite you to come back on the 3rd of May when my colleague Chris Brack will be chairing a panel discussion that will focus on the forests sector, broadly defined. That will be followed more or less at monthly intervals at the end of each month by panels that address other topic areas, and then conclude around the middle of the year with a sort of another big picture view of where we've got to. So please do join us for as many of those conversations as you can, but please come now and join us for drinks. To get to drinks, you have to take the flyover. There's a flyover just out here in the foyer, and go across the flyover and down one floor, and you'll hear the sound of glasses tinkling. So look forward to seeing you all there. But please join me in thanking the panel.